Castle National map that you see indicated here. So you've heard about Dama, for instance, that is located in the same map. So we're not located actually in one of the major halls. We're located back here in the interferometer tunnel, so somewhat off the main, off the big halls. But since we started at Xenon 10, we had here our shield installed. We're still using the same shield with some modifications. So at the current time, we're still good. But right now, then for next generations, we'll have to move to some other place because we run out of space. That's not working. Okay. Well, just very briefly, of course, so I'm again talking about direct detection. Of course, dark matter has been detected for a long time, as you know, for 75 years plus in astrophysics. And it has been stressed quite a few times here at the workshop how little we know about dark matter. I think it's also fair to say that we actually have learned quite a bit about dark matter, especially if you compare it to dark energy. So we have this idea that there are, it is actually made out of some particles that should produce somehow cold dark matter from structure formation, and things like, for instance, modifications of gravity to explain those effects have been pretty much ruled out. But there have been a lot of things that have been learned from astrophysics, but all of that, of course, through gravitational effects. And now we had all these discussions here about indirect detection and direct detection. This, I think, we had no talk about the other approach also that is looking in accelerators, of course, for the physics that that would produce dark matter particles or the dark matter particle itself. So the idea, of course, is that we have here this dark matter halo that is huge compared to the visible galaxy. And somewhere in there, we will place our direct detection detector. So somewhere out here in the galaxy would be Xenon 100. And we try to measure now directly, well, in the standard scenario, nuclear recoils. But you have heard so many non-standard scenarios. And I'll talk about that just a little bit as well. So there can be elastic scattering or maybe inelastic scattering. And then there will be spin-independent or maybe spin-dependent cross-sections. And the spin-independent cross-sections typically would give a coherent enhancement. So that tends to be, in at least most of the scenarios that we have been looking at, advantageous. Well, and then the type of recoil spectra one would be looking at are shown here. I'll come back to that in just a little bit. So let me maybe go over that just very briefly. So this is gives you this kind of steep spectra. And what you see is that for xenon, you can do very well as a function of energy if you go to very low thresholds. The scattering rate, of course, is then somehow just proportional to the target atoms you have. Of course, the time that you, well, that the rate is proportional to the number of atoms that you give it, the local dark matter density, which is, well, in standard scenarios, at least is uncertain by a factor of 2, maybe, and then, of course, the cross section. Well, and just as one example that seems to be getting completely out of fashion, at least if I follow this workshop, so no one talked about even, I think, Susie. The only thing I wanted to point out here is that there is really the spin-independent and spin-dependent and type of cross-section. And we are actually with xenon sensitive to both. One of the issues, of course, when we go for direct detection is that we have these extremely low rates. And so we need to find all these types of backgrounds. And I just wanted to mention a few of these. The biggest background often, but that depends on the type of experiment, are gamma rays and beta decays. So you want to have very good discrimination or background discrimination against that. And I'll show you how we do that. Of course, you have then, in addition to that, in any case, sort of passive shielding and with low activity lead or with water or with noble liquids. There are many approaches to that, and you've heard a few of those examples, how people do that in previous talks. Neutrons are a concern because neutrons at least would produce nuclear recoils, and so they would, in principle, fake a WIMP signal. And you can get neutrons either from spontaneous fission or from alpha N reactions in rock and concrete in your detector materials. Or you can get very high energy neutrons from cosmic ray muons, and that's where this plot that you have seen in various variations comes into play. So these are produced by high energy muons. So in principle, just by going deeper, this is a background that one can reduce just by doing that. Otherwise, if it gets to be a problem, and at least for us so far, the calculations are that it is not a problem yet, but we are getting close to it, then you may need a muon veto or a neutron veto or some more sophisticated shielding approaches. And then alpha decays from radon daughters, you just heard a lot about that in the previous talk. So I'm talking about the xenon program, and to give you somewhat of an overview, this program has started in 2002. My group has been part of that from the beginning, in fact, and initially we had a long period where we were doing R&D, which then culminated in the first dark matter detector, xenon 10, which then published its result in, I think we should say announced it in 2007. I think it took actually until 2008 until we published it. But so the limit was a bit better than 10 to the minus 43 square centimeter, and spin independent was at the time the best limit. And you have heard, meanwhile, has CDMS has surpassed us at the higher masses. I think we still hold a little bit at the lower mass end the lead, but it's very, very much now a neck and neck race, and Zeppelin 3, you've heard a talk, has produced a limit that is very much comparable with that. What I'm talking about today is xenon 100, the current next generation instrument. The idea being that we want to get the background down by a factor of 100. So xenon 10 was a proof of principle, and with xenon 100, we were much more strict about material choices and all kind of measures to reduce background. And at the same time, we increased the mass by a factor of 10. We didn't originally get actually the kind of instrument funded that we wanted to when we wrote the proposal. And so we have been insisting that we still do that. But we have actually been approved to also do the upgrade, which is actually more like the type of instrument that we wanted to do originally when we proposed xenon 100. Not that this would be any uninteresting. We will reach we are planning to get down to a level of 2 times 10 to the minus 45 square centimeter. I'll show you that later on some plots. That's maybe more clear. But by using lower background light sensors and by doubling the drift length, we'll actually be able to get another factor of 10 with this upgrade of xenon 100. And then the longer-term goal of the xenon program has been from the very beginning when we wrote the first proposal, a one-ton detector with xenon. And the idea really being that one shows in steps that one can do that. And as I'm going to show you how far we are now with xenon 100, we are quite confident that we will be getting to the one-ton scale. This is a somewhat outdated photo already from, I think, summer 08. Of the xenon 100 collaboration. There are currently 3 US institutions, and until recently there were 3 European institutions. We have just added 3 European groups in Germany, two European groups in Germany and France, and then 2 Asian groups in Japan, and one of our formerly graduate students and postdocs and so on just became an assistant professor in Shanghai Jiao Tong University, and where he's building up a group and is joining our collaboration. So why is liquid xenon good for dark matter search? You've heard about some of that already. So let me just stress a few points. So of course, xenon is a high Z material, which means it is very good to absorb gamma rays, and that is an important feature as it provides self-shielding. So we have a 3D position sensitive detector, and that means if you think of background being mainly at the surface, and that is where another important feature of xenon comes in, there are no long-lived isotopes in xenon, so there's no bulk background. And so the only bulk background that we have is the main one is krypton 85, and we know how to reduce that to the appropriate levels. It's a high Z and therefore also high A material. And as I told you, the spin, or as you know much better than I do, the spin independent interactions go with A squared. And so that's what makes xenon very attractive. Here I show you once more this plot. you go to low energy thresholds, and that turns over eventually because of the nuclear form factor that gets less favorable at larger momentum transfer. So if you want to operate a xenon detector, you make sure that you get a low energy threshold. The scalability is one of the big features of liquid noble gas detectors. We think that they are scalable to tons or even multi-tons. That's, of course, very attractive. And much of that has to do, of course, with the fact that the cryogenics are, even though liquid xenon is at minus 100 degrees centigrade, it is certainly much easier than, let's say, going to, into the 50 millikelvin area, as some of our colleagues have to do. So a xenon is a very efficient and fast scintillator. And I'll talk a little bit about the background discrimination. So how does it work? You've seen that already, so let me just remind you. The idea is that you have an interaction in a drift volume where you have the liquid xenon. So you want to have a high density material to get a lot of mass in a small volume. And just to give you an idea, one cubic meter, if you think of a ton scale detector, is actually not very big. It's a cubic meter of xenon is 3 tons, okay, just to give you an idea on the density. So 3 times denser than water. Here's where you have an interaction. You have an electric field applied between a cathode and a mesh system up here. If you blow this up in a zoom, then you actually see there are 3 meshes an hour the way we do things. One is here in the liquid, which closes off the drift region, where you have somewhat of a moderate drift field of order 1 kilovolt per centimeter. And then you have a much higher, about 10 times higher field across this liquid gas interface, so you can, with 100% efficiency, extract electrons. And at the same field, you produce then proportional scintillation up here, which means you amplify the charge signal and you can read it out with the same light readout system, namely these PMT arrays on the top and on the bottom, that also read out the primary scintillation light, which I indicated here. So the primary scintillation light, we call it the S1 signal. And then we have the secondary charge signal, which is converted into an amplified light signal, which is the S2. But this is shown here. So what we measure are, in the end, 2 light signals. And a gamma ray event would have a high ratio, would have a large amount of charge. And so S2 compared to S1 is larger. So S2 is always larger because we have this amplification. But the ratio is even larger for gamma rays than it is for nuclear recoils. And so we use this S2 over S1. And you saw some of that with the with Nigel Smith's talk on the Zeppelin experiment already. This is one important way to distinguish electrons from electronic recoils from nuclear recoils. OK, I think I've told you all of this. So here's an example of just this background discrimination in xenon 10. Up here, you see a cesium gamma ray source, and you see this mean. And down here, the blue line is where you have the mean of the nuclear recoil. And if you accept the 50% hit in your acceptance, you would stay below this blue line. Then the discrimination power that we found in xenon 10 was in the range of the dark matter search that we did between a factor of 200 and 1,000, somewhat depending on energy. Now, an equally important, or you may say, especially in the light of what has been discussed, I'll come to that in a moment, with annual modulation, maybe even more important than the S2 over S1, is the background reduction that you get from being able to do exquisite 3D position reconstruction in this chamber. And so when I say exquisite, I mean that you can really measure on millimeter scales. And that's a difference to the single phase detectors that have somehow 10 centimeter type of position resolution. So they need to stay far away from the surfaces. You heard just a talk that discussed how important, in their case, surface impurities are. In our case, we just make a sharp cut, and we can make a sharp cut, and we know where we are. So that is a big, powerful method, and that is shown here. What you see are the events here clustered at the edge. In fact, I need to get a better plot of that. There is still also a geometric projection effect in this particular scatter plot. But anyway, the most of the background, or the background in the dark matter region, comes from the surface. And the xenon 10 has this very good self-shielding property, which gets better as you build larger detectors. So you can then cut out a smaller volume, the fiducial volume in xenon 10. This was 5.4 kilograms, and this was the box where we looked for dark matter. So I wanted to make a few points, since we had a very nice talk yesterday on the status of the Dharma-Libra result, where this annual modulation is being seen. And I wanted to point out that xenon 100 will be as sensitive or more sensitive to annual modulation than the Dharma-Libra. And so how does that work? This is exactly based on the position reconstruction. So the advantage that we have is that we get this very low background. So if you look at the background in the Dharma-Libra, you get something like one event per kilogram per day, and KeV, these standard units that you have grown accustomed to. And the annual modulation signal is just 2% of that, okay? So clearly dominated by background. The predictions for the background in xenon 100 are 100 times lower in this central volume. The sensitivity, when you look at it, they scale with the square root of the exposure divided by the background rate. So if you do an estimate of the exposure now, Dharma-Libra has, of course, a tremendous amount of exposure, much more exposure than anybody else. And that will even remain so with the scale of xenon 100. But we will have some 6,000 kilogram days when we're done with xenon 100. And that compares to about 2 × 10^5, I think, for Dharma-Libra alone. And then you got some additional from previously Dharma sodium iodide in the published result. So there are a large factor ahead, but then we have the factor 100 lower in background. If you do the math, then you find out that this figure of merit under the square root is actually a factor 3 better for xenon 100 than it is in the currently published result by Dharma and Libra. So we will, running for a year, we'll be highly sensitive to annual modulation. And I think that is very significant, because this is the background before doing discrimination against nuclear recoils. Okay, so this is also electromagnetic. This includes all the electromagnetic backgrounds. So I think we should be very good with that. Okay, so let me summarize a little bit where we are. The previous generation xenon 10, this was the result that we published at the time, and you saw that meanwhile CDMS, got some plot on that later, has picked up. This was the status 2 years ago, where we were then able with xenon 10 to cut deep into the spin independent cross section. At the same time, maybe a little less known, is that we also achieve the best limit for spin-dependent for unpaired neutrons. So we have about 50% odd isotopes in xenon, and that's actually an interesting feature of xenon as well. So in principle, if you were to find dark matter and you get the money for that, you could actually test spin-dependent versus spin-independent by just isotopically enriching xenon one way or the other. So all even nuclei or all odd nuclei, and you could test in the same detector spin-dependent versus spin-independent cross-sections. So xenon 10 is here and has now currently the best limit still and spin-dependent with uncoupled neutrons, but still not so really interesting compared to where the theory is, but somewhat getting close. And with xenon 100, we'll get correspondingly deeper, and we'll actually be cutting into that range of supersymmetry predictions in that case. Okay, now the current generation xenon 100, what you see here is we're still in the same shield. We have done some modification. We have added some low activity copper inside to further reduce the background. We are also adding now some more water, in fact, on the outside to further reduce neutron backgrounds. But the main thing is really in the detector itself. So it's a complete new detector. It's 10 times larger, and we went now through a very dedicated effort of screening the materials that we placed inside and moving all the materials outside that we didn't as far away from the detector and outside of the shield. For instance, the cooling system is now outside, which for xenon 10 was just sitting on top of the detector. So we have now something like 70 kilogram in the target volume and 170 kilogram in total. The reason why this number is quite a bit larger has to do with the fact that we also have an active liquid xenon vetos completely surrounding our inner volume. So we get some additional background suppression from that. And yeah, all of this aimed at getting a factor 100 lower background. This is the engineering drawing. This is an actual photo of it being assembled. So you see here the field cage with the Teflon reflecting cage in the middle. And out here, what you see here are the veto PMTs. You cannot see, and down here, what you cannot see the inner main PMT arrays, which are covered. The upper ones are inside this bell. This, by the way, is another feature of this detector. There's the so-called diving bell. So we actually have a gas volume. And on top of that sits, again, a liquid volume for to have an active veto here. And at the same time, we can control very nicely the liquid gas interface inside the bell. Now, some ideas. These are the pictures of the PMT arrays, the top array and the bottom array. This is just an impression of how we do the calibrations with an LED, and we look for the single photoelectron peak and to calibrate the gain and to monitor the gain. These are the meshes that we're using now. So we have there was quite a bit of optimization also compared to xenon 10 in optimizing the field meshes to get very good energy resolution up here, as well as maximizing the light transparency at the same time, which are somewhat conflicting requirements. We have a new data acquisition system compared to xenon 10. The reason was that xenon 10 was limited, especially for the calibration in the rate in which we could take data, and that really hurt us at some point then, that we just were not able to gather reasonably fast sufficient statistics in for calibration. So we really wanted to change that for xenon 100, apart from the fact that we have now three times more channels than we had in xenon 10. And so we developed with KAIN. So KAIN has this commercial module that has FPGAs on it. And we developed a specific programming for our purpose, namely the purpose being that we are interested only in S1 and S2. We are sampling very fast, namely once every 10 nanoseconds, because the scintillation signal of xenon is so fast. There's a decay time of 30 nanoseconds. And so we can sample our light very fast. But then we have all this time where we are really just interested at the time difference between S1 and S2 and the fact that there is no other signal in there. But we're not interested in measuring this zero or this baseline all the time. So what we do is we cut away all of this in between by setting a threshold. And especially for calibrations, then this allows us to go to much higher rate or significantly higher rates. And we can run, for instance, at 50 hertz, whereas dark matter runs would be running at maybe 1 hertz. So what are the expected backgrounds in the dark matter search region? This is from Monte Carlo simulations. And what you see here is, again, the now here we don't have this geometric projection effect. Here it's already corrected for really the density of background. And as you can see, you have the background coming from the outside. And in particular, they come from the photomultiplier tubes. So the photomultiplier tubes are a dominant source of background, which is why for the next generation, that's also something we want to improve. And I'll come back to that. Now we have measured, these are now data from xenon 100, the light spectrum, where we compare this with Monte Carlo. And you can see that overall, our expectations seem to be fitting quite well with our data. But this is still fairly preliminary, because we have only recently really gotten to the point where we can also measure the charge, which is then important for us to do to look at the position, the spatial distribution, and so forth. Now, one thing that I wanted to mention briefly, I said there is no bulk radioactivity in xenon. That is not exactly true. There is a by default a contamination with natural krypton, and natural krypton contains krypton 85, which meanwhile is which is made in small amounts by cosmic rays, but mostly man-made in nuclear reactors, and a lot of it was actually freed in atmospheric tests that are now slowly decaying away with a half-life of 10 years or 11 years. So krypton 85 is around, and the first thing, even already in xenon 10, if you just get the cleanest, the highest purity xenon, and you fill your detector in this low background environment with xenon 10, our first measurement was all you see is krypton 85. So clearly, it was already known for years that we needed to reduce krypton 85. There are different ways how to do that. The approach we are taking is, well, first of all, we pay a company that provides us with pure xenon already to give us particularly pure xenon, so where the krypton level is already reduced to 10 ppb. this is done with cryogenic distillation. And then we can measure krypton 85 using a delayed coincidence technique, which I indicate here. So we have this 10.8-year half-life of krypton 85 that is a beta minus decay. And in 99.5% of all cases, you just go directly to the ground state. But then there is a 0.4% chance that you end up in this metastable level that has a half-life of a microsecond. And then, where you have then a reduced maximum energy for the beta. And then you get a 514 kV gamma ray. And we can look for these delayed coincidences. And we can measure directly the krypton level. And so we measured what we got from spectrogases was what they promised. It was 7 plus minus 2 ppb. And so we needed more because our science goal requires about 50 ppt of krypton 85, which corresponds to about one leakage event per year in a 50 kilogram fiducial mass. So we bought a Japanese cryogenic distillation column that was originally designed for the X-mass experiment. This is about a 3 meter or maybe a bit more taller, 3 meter plus tall column in which you essentially feed in xenon and you have a, you try to use the difference in boiling points between krypton and xenon to get a flow of very pure xenon and higher contaminated, enriched, in krypton enriched xenon on the upper portion. And you can, it is designed that you can reduce krypton this way by a factor of 1,000. We have run this once last fall with not quite optimized conditions yet. And we are currently measuring again with the coincidence technique now very sensitively where we are. It is now so low that we actually have to measure for quite some time before we can actually assess how much is in there. So we are somewhat getting close to where we want to be, but we're assessing whether we need to run this once more or whether we're good enough. So we had a little bit of delay trying to get our detector as clean as we need to. We want to drift across 30 centimeters. And the first thing that you need to do is to see the light very well in the entire detector. So initially, we had quite a bit of impurities from water and that were hampering the light. And so you can see here from two runs that we did how the light yield increased with time. And then since early May, we have been now at a stage where we have really made big progress in our purification. So now we're able to measure and drift charges across our detector volume. And in fact, we have reached the milestone that we're drifting across all the 30 centimeters and the purity is currently increasing day by day. I think now it's somewhere around 180 microseconds. That compares, to give you a reference, I think I saw yesterday for Zeppelin 3, we're around 25 microseconds, I believe, something like that. And in xenon 10, however, we were much better. We had about 2 milliseconds lifetime. So we would still like to get better. So far, it's going up. So we're still going to, we're starting our calibrations. And essentially, by the time we do a dark matter run, we hope we'll have quite a bit better purity even. This is our real data. You can see here now we can do XY reconstruction. This is actually the size of the detector. Now you may wonder why do we have events outside of our detector, which is somewhat unusual. That has to do with the fact that very close to the edge, you actually get a reconstruction that tends to move them further out. We have studied that with Monte Carlos quite a bit. This is work by my graduate student. And it turns out that the reconstruction works such that at the very edges where you get the poorest reconstruction, you tend to move them further out, which is a safe error of reconstruction because we will be cutting inwards ultimately. So here are some examples of light and charge spectra that were taken not too long time ago, end of May in this case. Okay, so this is the status of Xenon 100. Now let me talk about Xenon, the upgrade that has been now approved by NSF. So what we want to do is sort of go a parallel approach. We want to now start then running with Xenon 100 and get a first result, and then probably run the Xenon 100 as long as is reasonable given the background rate that we are then going to have measured rather than predicted. And one of the things, so there are a few things that we want to do in the upgrade. First of all, we want to test a new set of photomultipliers, or I should say light sensors. They're not really traditional photomultipliers. They're so-called qubits. So let me maybe go one slide ahead briefly. A qubit is a design that Katsushi Arisaka and Hanguo Wang at UCLA have a joint patent with Hamamatsu on. It is the idea of a hybrid, what is called a hybrid PMT. In principle, if you use a low radioactivity quartz envelope, which also has the advantage of being transparent to the UV light of xenon, and so this is a 3-inch tube, and you apply a high negative voltage to it such that you focus the field lines, so here the field simulations, onto an avalanche photodiode in the center of this construction. And the idea being that you have some 6 kilovolts or 10 kilovolts. You know, I think it has been tested up to 6 really right now, but in principle it could go to 10. And then you accelerate the electrons. You actually get a gain as you impact with this high energy electron on the APD, and then you get the intrinsic gain of the APD, which combines to give you sufficient gain to go then out with your signal to the preamplifier. This we have screened these devices, and they have per square area, they have at least a factor of 10 lower radioactivity than our current PMTs, which are already sort of at the forefront of radioactivity in terms of traditional photomultiplier tubes. So this is really a big step forward, and this will reduce the currently predominant background in xenon 100 significantly, and is an important ingredient then for a one-ton scale experiment. So coming back to xenon 100 plus, the idea is that apart from wanting to get about a factor of 10 more sensitive mostly by reducing background, we want to test techniques that we need for the ton scale. One of the things is we need a long drift. So for a one-ton experiment, we'll be drifting on something on the order of 80 centimeters or 1 meter, at least in the traditional designs. And here we'll be, again, doubling our drift length. So we doubled our drift length going from xenon 10 to xenon 100, and we'll again double our drift length to go to 60 centimeters. And so we want to prove that we can do that. I mean, in theory, we know already that we can do it even with xenon 10 with the purity. But just by extrapolation, we would have drifted that far. But then there are other issues like the high voltage. And so there are various things that one needs to look at that is relevant for the ton scale that we want to prove already then in this upgrade phase. We'll also need, we're going to use a muon veto because we think that we are getting at the edge. This is supposed to have low enough background to be able to run maybe for 2 years. And we are concerned that our neutron background may catch up with us. So we want to add a muon veto as well. And so I've already mentioned the xenon one ton. There are already plans for that. We, in various incarnations, either in Europe or at Doozle, if it goes along. So we have, we're part of the MAX collaboration here for the S4 proposal, of those of you that are familiar with the US NSF system, preparing for Doozle, where we combine forces with liquid argon dual phase people that to think about a ton or multi-ton scale TPC in a design study for Doozle. So let me just summarize, and this is a somewhat already dated plot. Things move too fast, so I apologize. Zeppelin 3, I think, was not yet on here, which is very similar to xenon 10, a bit lower on this side and a bit higher on the lower mass side. So I just wanted to summarize a little bit where we are with these direct searches. So you have on the right-hand side, you have spin-independent. On the left-hand side, you have spin-dependent for neutron, unpaired neutron coupling, unpaired proton coupling, and you saw Ubi Rykalski's plot, I think he indicated, correct me if I'm wrong, a line that was somewhere here. So I think they will be improving on that pretty soon. There were also works on looking at the low mass here of where there were ideas that the Dharma annual modulation signal might be able to be even reconciled with sort of regular elastic scattering models if the mass is very low. And so there was work on that. And I think CDMS is doing work on that as well. So that's sort of the state of the art. And the idea of from the xenon perspective right now, and you've seen other plots on Lux, on Deep, and so forth, where they want to go. So I'm showing you the xenon perspective. So what we want to go to on the spin-independent cross-sections is to go to ultimately 2 times 10 to the minus 45 with xenon 100, a factor of 10 down with xenon 100 plus, and then eventually we would like to reach with a 1-ton fiducial, so something like a 3-ton detector, we think we would be able to get down to nearly 10 to the minus 47 square centimeter in cross-section. Maybe interesting, and this is a plot I stole a long time ago from Rick Gaitskill's review, which is, of course, is correspondingly dated, 5 years old. So I just added sort of the xenon history to that, and sorry for not adding all the other plots. I need to somehow redo that plot at some point. But one thing that I thought was interesting was if you look at how this progression over 25 years with improving sensitivities from initially fairly slow, trying to understand the detectors, and then really mostly, I would say, maybe CDMS driving the sensitivity curve over the last decade or so. And we hope that with the liquid xenon approach, we'll be able to give that an even steeper slope down. Of course, also the funding agencies have a big saying on this kind of slope here. But I think from a technical standpoint, we think that this is possible. OK, so that's, I think, all I have to say. Let me see whether there's anything in my summary that I need to stress. I think maybe the main thing I want to get across here is that we are now getting very close with xenon 100 to, so we're starting with calibration, so we're getting very close to doing our dark matter run. I think we'll be starting in the fall with that. There's already an approved upgrade of it, which will be going somewhat in parallel, and we're currently figuring out how that's going to be with space, whether hopefully Grand Sasso will be more forthcoming with space in that regard, but we're also looking at other options there. And I think our timeline is very good in that LHC finally is supposed to be starting this fall, and so they will eventually come up also with some interesting either detections or limits, or will tell us something about what's going on at the TEV scale. And of course, you've heard about Fermi and all the other indirect searches, Pamela and all that you've heard about. So I think it's very exciting. Thank you.
Short technical question. So the purification column for the xenon, the krypton removal, is that the actual one that they used, or did they build a new one for you?
No, it's a company, a Japanese company, that built it for XMAS, and they built one for us as well.
Ah, okay.
So you can buy it from the company.
We'll go back to the first page.
The first page? The title page?
Second.
Okay. So I lost my scroll bar. Yes.
I just wanted to remind you there is an experiment, a little tiny experiment called the ADDIE. And second is a question. That's just a comment.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. That was yeah.
And second question. This you mentioned about this drift length increase for this time scale issue. Are you saying though that technical issue is resolved for you to actually achieve this 10 to the minus 47 within a few years?
I think that it is realistic. I'm not saying that we have, we wouldn't be building it tomorrow, but I think the main issue, so some of the issues that we want to see is how these qubits work in the large array. So that's something we're going to address with this upgrade, and I think they're going to work great. It looks like they're going to work great. If you're interested, I can show you a few plots on that. But then there are issues, the question, how do you do that with the high voltage? But it has been done, for instance, for Icarus to put in a large amount of large high voltages into cryogenic liquid argon in that case. So I think, in principle, all these things can all be solved. I don't see a principal problem, that's what I'm
saying.
But as I also stressed, I mean, our approach really has been to do these phased steps. So we go sort of in moderate steps forward, and every time we learn something, for instance, now with Xenon 100, we just learned a little bit about that we were maybe too optimistic in how fast we get our detector cures, and next time we'll be more careful with a few of those things. But it works, okay? So we can get there.
So. Okay. Good enough.
Yeah.
Oh, my question is about the energy threshold that you claim to reach with the Xenon 10 and then also with the scale-up versions. An energy threshold of 2 keV seems very optimistic, considering the fact that the response of the detector is 1-2 photoelectron per keV. I remind you that, for instance, for sodium iodide detectors, in our case, we have more than 5 or 6 photoelectrons per kV, having the same energy threshold you claim. So, in my opinion, it's too optimistic, and we say it several times. This is my comment.
Okay, I can tell you from Xenon 10, of course, it's not a claim, but it's a measurement. So, we know where we are for Xenon 10.
The energy threshold you have just 3 photoelectrons, 2 or 3 photoelectrons.
We have with field, we have 3.
Also the
mm-hmm. So in Xenon 10, we have with field 3.2, I think, average photoelectrons per KeV with the field, without field 4 point something. And so this is, and we are now with Xenon 100, we're close to that. We're not quite. So it's not quite yet at the level of Xenon 10, so we're looking right now into that, but we're fairly close. And for Xenon 1-ton, one thing I didn't stress very much, but let me just show you that briefly. And the Xenon 1-ton, so there have been quite a bit of Monte Carlo simulations in that regard at UCLA. So Katsushi Arisaka has been having that effort. Something is going weird here, sorry. Okay, that's good. If you look at this particular plot, one thing that is a different, there is actually, UCLA, they were making a point of to address this kind of question to actually go to a 4-pi readout, which of course comes at some cost in terms of readout, but which also would have been prohibited if you had a high radioactivity in your photosenders. But since these are so extremely low radioactivity photosenders, this actually becomes a really viable option. And that's not, this is a sketch, right? It's not a final design. But there have been quite a bit of Monte Carlo efforts going into looking at, for instance, the light yield. And definitely, this would have very good light collection efficiency. And the question is, if you didn't want to do that, if you stay with the current design of just bottom top, of course, you get a larger variation of light yield across the detector. And you're right, that would affect your energy threshold.
I have a question. So if you look at your background, the inner part of the detector, that looks like a gamma emission. Can you resolve sometimes the peak structure that presumably comes from gamma decays or some radioactive? Can you tell or like
yes.
The CDMS had shown the plots where they had the peak.
Well, you are talking about the energy threshold. This is another issue of this kind of detectors. The energy threshold of Xenon detectors are too poor with respect to many other scintillators or with respect to the borometers.
So this is just actually incorrect. There's one thing in Xenon that is curious. Maybe you have, or maybe not so curious, but if you look at the there's this anti-correlation. I think it was I think Nigel Smith mentioned that between charge and light. I'm not sure, but thought on that. We did quite a few studies with that with xenon 10, but I don't think I have any slide in here right now. So if anyone's interested in the coffee break, I can show some other ones. So you can look at charge. This is actually still a very poor charge spectrum. This has a lot to do with being still relatively poor in purity, being still sometime in May. So that's going to be improving. But then you can actually combine these two, and you actually get much better energy resolution. And in fact, you get better energy resolution than sodium iodide, by the way. S1, S2, if you combine the two, we had at 122 keV with xenon 10, 3% sigma. So maybe 4%. But yeah, so a very good energy resolution, not as good as we can get with germanium, but pretty good.
So you could look for extra big structures.
Yes, yeah, so which energy would you be interested in? Yes. So.
Any, right? Okay. Yes. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, so essentially, one issue is that when it goes to too high energy, at some point we saturate. We have this, I think we heard that yesterday also from Zeppelin. So right now with these, with our readout chain, we're optimized to probably, I don't know yet with xenon 100, we have to really map this out, but it will be limited somewhere to 100 keV or so, and then we start saturating. But we can also go into a mode where we then focus more on high energies if that was of interest. So in principle, you can tune the parameters to do that.
Very good.
Other questions?
Following up on the Cupid aspect,
yes.
Is the reason that you're worried about the background of the photomultiplier just the trigger rate? I thought the whole idea of scaling up was so that you had a lower background in the center of the xenon.
Yes.
So it's purely the trigger rate, which is the problem.
Well, I mean, it's both. You also get ultimately you also get neutrons from the PMPs. They would be penetrating somewhat deeper. But yeah, so one of the reasons also to go to longer is if you're still just dominated by background. So for instance, for the xenon 100 upgrade, we'll actually keep the upper PMP array. It's a fairly modest upgrade, if you like. So we'll keep a lot of what we have already. We'll be probably reusing those photomultipliers that we already have. And so those will still be high radioactivity, but we'll have the very low radioactivity on the bottom.
All right, let's thank Uwe again. Okay.